is a pattern or a combination, 3-1, and this pattern runs throughout Scripture. It's amazing, you know, it's how you don't see it, and then when you do see it, the 3-1 combination is all over the place. And so when you bring those different places where this combination is illustrated together, they begin to expand the prophetic understanding of what took place in the Millerite movement, what takes place in the fourth angel's message time period. And we cover that in a study called The Prophetic Pattern. We have a study on Revelation 16. I think that's 4 hours. Then we have a study called The Purification of God's Church. It's about 9 hours long, and most of us haven't focused in very seriously on the purification of God's church, but in Bible prophecy, it is clear that how God cleanses His church is at the Sunday law. And this has a big impact on how we understand Adventism today, when we see the things going on in the church that are going on in the church, and we have to make decisions. Are we supposed to separate? Is the church Babylon? But the reality is, His inspiration has said that God will cleanse His church in His own way and His own means. We have a study called The Prophetic Time, where we deal with the daily, and we deal with God's denominated people and time setting all in that study. That's 10 hours. We have a study on Gideon. The story of Gideon has just about every characteristic that Adventism understands takes place in Adventism in it. Gideon is a type of Adventism at the end of the world. A very interesting study. We have a crowning act study, which goes over the personation of Christ by Satan, putting it in the time period that Satan appears just after the Sunday law. He's allowed to continue his masquerade until human probation closes. That's what inspiration says. Between the Sunday law in the United States and the close of human probation is when the personation of Christ takes place, and we try to make a connection with the fact that Satan intends to use the Catholic Church as the religious structure to bring this deception upon the world. Sister White says the Catholic Church was the masterpiece of his efforts to place itself upon the throne of the earth. So how is it the Catholic Church is going to cooperate with Satan when he returns and personates Christ? And we go into the messages of the Virgin Mary in the apparitions and demonstrate that the Catholic Church has been prepared philosophically through the apparitions of Mary to believe that when Satan's personating Christ, that that is Christ, and they are waiting to turn their organization over to him. That's the crowning act. Then we have a study called Those Things Which Have Been Will Be Repeated, and it is the study where we hopefully show that the national reform movement of Sister White's day and age that was pushing for a Sunday law is the type of the Christian coalition. It's the description of it's the evidence that what the Christian coalition is accomplishing right now is about to bring Sunday law into the United States. We have a study called The Judgment of the Living, which tries to point out that probation closes progressively. And if you don't think of probation closing progressively, then you miss some of the truths about what's going on in the most holy place. Although we all understand that, we don't think about it. As Seventh-day Adventists, we do understand that probation, that judgment is progressive, because we understand that judgment begins with the dead, and at some point in time it moves to the living. So we know that basically, but we haven't thought it through to some of the depths that we need to see how the Sunday law is the tool that the Lord uses to bring judgment to a close, and that it's the Sunday law test that first confronts God's people and then confronts people outside of God's church. We have a study called Adventism's Parable, where we look at Matthew 25 in connection with Daniel 11, 40-45. And, of course, all of this, it's pretty much covered in the DVDs. When I'm saying DVDs, they also come in videos, VHS. They also come in audio tape, but I'm suggesting those because in the 40-hour prophecy school, we had two or three big whiteboards, and the things that we were putting on those boards are all on the DVDs, and in reality, I've never looked at one of those DVDs, but I know there's some people in here that have. I'm confident that they're well done and they're professional, but you've looked at the DVDs, right, Bud, Carol? They're good. Oh yeah, when I was putting together the PowerPoint, I'm colorblind and I'm not too artistic, even if I wasn't colorblind. So in my PowerPoint that I prepared for the prophecy school, everyone said I had bad colors. So the brother that did the video work before he finally produced it, he went in and he changed all the colors in the. So it's none of that. You won't have a problem with that. It's all. I'm bad on colors. So I would recommend that if you want to cover this material completely.
Do you have one of your monthly letters that tell
us? If you sign up for our monthly newsletter, when I get home, okay, then just give me. You get the Spanish or the. Okay, if you just give me a note that you want. Once a year or so, this is the one from September 2004. In one newsletter a year, we'll put the things that are for sale. And I only have this for the sales. And if you need it before we go, I have to take this with me. Maybe we can get copies of this. Or you can just give me a note, and when I get home, I can call my wife even this afternoon, and she can send you this. Anyway, I was killing some time before. Well, Harold got the camera ready. If you're ready, I'm ready. Shall we pray? Heavenly Father, we once again invite your presence into this meeting. We ask that your Holy Spirit and angels would abide with us at this time, and that the words spoken would be for your honor and glory, and that they'd be truthful. We ask that you'd give us willing hearts to hear and understand, and willing hearts to fully surrender to you at this point in Earth's history, that we can be tools in your hands in finishing this work, first in our own lives, in our homes, and then in carrying this message to the world. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. If you would turn to Daniel chapter 11. I was in this congregation not that long ago, but prior to that, I hadn't been here for quite a while, but I had been in this area on a regular basis. So in my mind's eye, I assumed that most of us that would be at these meetings this weekend would be semi-familiar with the prophetic material that we share. So as I was preparing for this meeting, I was preparing to present things that were a little bit further down the line of this prophetic, farther into this prophetic material than I plan on sharing in Ventura this coming weekend. I've never been to Ventura. I'm assuming that the majority of those people may not have ever even thought about Daniel 11, 40 to 45. So when I go somewhere like that, that's what I do. I focus on Daniel 11, 40 to 45 foundation. Same thing with the following weekend in Blythe. But I assumed here there was some people, a good percentage of the people, that were already familiar with what we were saying. And I want to share some things that have recently come into this study. And so when I got here Friday night and yesterday, I realized it was too mixed, so I kind of backed out of my plans and just tried to share some things from prophecy that usually people find interesting in order to try to stimulate curiosity to people that were first being confronted with this, to encourage them to follow on and get some material and keep looking at this before they just forget about it. But today I would like to take up one of those things that I did plan on addressing when I first came out here. And in Daniel 11, verse 40 to 45, I believe that This is the foundation of the present truth prophetic message for God's people at the end of the world. And if this is so, then their inspiration is clear and logic also is clear, that you would expect that Satan would be attempting to prevent this message from being promoted and understood. And this, just the fact that there is resistance to what we're teaching does not prove that what we're teaching is correct. But if it is correct, you would expect resistance to be there. So I'm not saying just because people are opposing this, that proves that it's right. I'm not saying that. But I do want to address one of the issues that is what I understand from my interaction in this message. It is the heart of the argument. In verse 40 of Daniel 11, the verse teaches that in 1798, atheistic France, the king of the south, began a war against the papacy. The king of the south, king of the north, is only found in Daniel chapter 11, and the rule that the pioneers came to understand correctly is that the king of the south is the power that controls Egypt, the king of the north is the power that controls Babylon. Pioneers established that. There is also a rule that after the time period of the cross, prophecy is understood in its spiritual application. Before the time period of the cross, prophecy is understood in its literal application. Before the time period of the cross, a Jew was a literal blood descendant of Abraham. After the time period of the cross, a Jew was a spiritual Jew who was a descendant of Abraham by faith. This is a very important rule of Bible prophecy. It is a rule that the Catholic Church purposely has attempted to destroy in the Counter-Reformation by inventing false rules of prophetic interpretation to specifically attack this rule. This rule has a history in Protestantism, not only in Adventism, but in Protestantism. There have been books written about this rule and the attack of Catholicism against this rule. But up until the 20th century, every Protestant knew that these false rules of prophetic technique that were attempting to destroy the rule of before the cross literal, after the cross spiritual, they all knew that these false techniques were Catholic satanic attacks against the truth. But at the beginning of the 20th century, there was a Bible printed called the Scofield Bible that incorporated into its footnotes these thoughts from these Catholic false interpretations. And from that point on, as Protestants began to buy the Scofield Bible and be indoctrinated with these techniques, then Protestantism went to sleep on this particular rule. But when you get to verse 40 of Daniel 11, the rule of who the king of the south and the king of the north is still the same. The power that controls the king of the south is the power that controls, the king of the south is the power that controls Egypt. The king of the north is the power that controls Babylon. Only at this point in history, the time of the end, 1798, you are looking for the power that controls spiritual Egypt and the power that controls spiritual Babylon. It is not an accident that both of those powers are identified in the book of Revelation, because the books of Daniel and Revelation go together. And in Revelation 11, verse 8, spiritual Egypt is controlled by France during the French Revolution time period. And in the Great Controversy, Sister White informs us that Egypt in Revelation 11, verse 8, is identifying one of the characteristics of atheistic France, atheism. France is the power that controlled spiritual Egypt and spiritual Sodom, representing the two characteristics of France during the French Revolution time period, its atheism and its licentiousness. In other words, the power that controlled spiritual Egypt in the 1798 time period was atheistic France. And the power that controlled spiritual Babylon in the 1798 time period is also found in the book of Revelation. In Revelation 17, the woman that is riding upon the beast with the name Mystery Babylon on her forehead, Sister White, also in the Great Controversy, tells us very clearly that this is the Roman Church. You don't need Sister White for that. All you need is a dictionary that was printed before, say, the 1950s. And if you get a dictionary, an English dictionary that was published, you know, prior to the 1950s, and you look up Scarlet Woman, you're going to find that those people that were producing that dictionary knew that Scarlet Woman meant the Roman Church from Revelation chapter 17. The Protestant world used to understand that, but we have went to sleep. But in any case, when it comes to Daniel 11, verse 40, in 1798, the king of the south, atheistic France, was going to begin a war against the king of the north, the papacy, and sure enough, in 1798, history tells us that France took the pope captive, delivering the deadly wound. But the verse goes on and says that at some point in time, the papacy, the king of the north, would retaliate against the king of the south. And if you read the book Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith, and as I said, I have some differences of opinion in that book, but Sister White says that that book is God's helping hand. And brothers and sisters, I still agree with Sister White. I know of no finer book on Daniel and Revelation in Adventism than Uriah Smith's book, even in spite of some of his problems. She wanted some books on Daniel and Revelation written that were even simpler than Smith's or Haskell. She wanted just Daniel and Revelation with as little commentary as possible. Just she wanted them simplified where you could easily understand it. And I don't know if they ever accomplished that task. I prefer both. And you'll find that they are different styles of writing. And there's a sister that just came into Adventism in our local church, and she has been working through the material that we share, the DVD, and I gave her Uriah Smith, and she read that book, and you know it was difficult for her. And my wife yesterday on Sabbath gave her Haskell's two books. I think if you spend the time and you read, if you push yourself through Uriah Smith and then you push yourself through Haskell's, it's going to start coming together for you. Uriah Smith, to me, is more of a historian. There's more of the detail, which for some people is more difficult if they're not inclined to be view things from the historical aspect, where Haskell, he's giving a lot of biblical lessons in connection with Daniel, Revelation. It's a different style, but they complement one another. They have a little bit of different twist on certain things. In Uriah Smith's book, Daniel and Revelation, he points out that in the story of the king of the south and the king of the north in Daniel 11, that as history unfolded, who the king of the south and who the king of the north are changes. At this point in history, if this power controls Egypt, that's the king of the south. But later on, if another power conquers Egypt, he becomes the king of the south. And the pioneers, Uriah Smith, specifically pointed out that in the flow of Daniel 11, that is acceptable. And in verse 40, by the time you get to the conclusion of verse 40, there is a new king of the south. Because in 1917, there was a new power that came into history that was the one that was dominating the philosophy of atheism, which is symbolized by Egypt, and that power was Russia, the Soviet Union. And you'll notice that in verse 40 that when the papacy, the king of the north, sweeps away the Soviet Union, that it passes over the countries. Whoever the king of the south is when it's swept away is a confederacy of countries. And of course, Soviet Union was a confederacy of countries. And when the king of the north comes and does this, it brings with him an ally. And the ally is symbolized in the chariots, ships, and horsemen. And we know this is an ally because if you take your concordance, chariots and horsemen in the Bible represent military strength. And the papacy never has, in history or in prophecy, its own army. So the fact that when the papacy does sweep away the king of the south, it has chariots and horsemen with it, as I'm telling us, that there must be an ally with him, because the papacy never has its own army. And this ally also has ships, which, if you take a concordance, represents economic strength. And of course, this connects with Revelation 13, the two characteristics of power for the United States at the end of the world are military and economic strength. You cannot buy or sell without the mark of the beast. You are put to death without the mark of the beast. The books of Daniel and Revelation are the same book according to the spirit of prophecy. Sister White has a statement where she says, in the book of Revelation, the same line of prophecy is taken up as in the book of Daniel. This is one of the testing points for you, if you're going to consider whether someone's teaching the truth about Daniel and Revelation. Are they finding agreement in those two books? Because if they're finding disagreement, you got a problem. So, I'm suggesting that verse 40 was a verse that, brothers and sisters, when we do this, if you get the DVD, you'll find that we spend 4 or 5 hours on verse 40. There is that much information in verse 40. If you back up to verse 38, in verse 38, you're seeing the introduction of the worship of Mary into Catholicism. Okay, and I'm not going to spend time with that. But verse 38 is preceding verse 40, because when you come to verse 40 and you get into studying the history that is connected to verse 40, you find that in 1917, when the modern king of the South comes into history, Russia, when did Russia come into history? 1917, but what do we call that revolution? You call it the October Revolution. It took place in October 1917. One of the most significant dates for the modern King of the South is October 1917, and the most significant date for the modern King of the North is October 13th, 1917. Why? Because on October 13th, 1917, the miracle of Fatima occurred. And that miracle is the miracle that establishes the end time scenario for the papacy. So, brothers and sisters, it's not an accident that the event that is one of the most significant events in the history of the modern King of the South, the Soviet Union, takes place at the very month and year that the event that is the most significant for the modern King of the North. That's not an accident. And when you see that the worship of Mary is identified as coming into Catholicism in verse 38, you're seeing that this verse 38 is just leading into the significance of verse 40, and you can spend a great deal of time then discussing on what the apparitions of Mary and the messages of the Fatima, how they connect with verse 40. I got to stay on track. I've got a limited amount of time, so I'm going to have questions at the end.
No, I just wanted to give you a footnote on Fatima. There were 75,000 people that day
that witnessed the UFO that just hit about 70. Yeah, we covered that. When you were telling me that the other day, I was in... Amen in you, in my mind, I understand that. We cover that. When we have time, we identify the miracle. We identify the messages. We show how the messages, brothers and sisters, the messages, the three messages that establish the end time scenario for the papacy at the end of the world, we deal with in a study called The Crowning Act. And when you look at those messages in a general way and understand that they are satanic messages, okay, understand that they're satanic messages, but you realize that Catholicism, through the messages of Fatima, has been prepared for the end of the world. And some of the preparation that has taken place, let me give you a quick example and then back out of this. I don't want to go there very long. They believe that this pope here is the bad pope. Last pope was a good pope. Pope John Paul II was the good pope. This pope here is the bad pope. And the bad pope's only going to rule for a short period of time. Then the Third World War is going to break out, which is going to include nuclear weapons, where some entire countries are going to be wiped off the face of the earth. That's how the Fatima messages have prepared Catholicism. And Sister White says, the last days wars will rage. The Bible confirms that too. And Fatima has told Catholicism that in this war, the nuclear fallout is going to melt the ice caps, and the oceans are going to rise, and the oceans are going to overflow some countries. And Sister White says, in the last days, the oceans are going to overflow the banks. And they say that this nuclear war, this Third World War, will be very brief, and it will end with the return of Jesus. And Jesus will then pronounce a blessing upon the good pope, and there's some other stuff connected with that. But do you know how the Virgin Mary has prepared Catholic mindset to understand who Jesus is when he returns? When he returns, they will know he's Jesus. Why? Because he calls fire down out of heaven. So when you look at the preparation that takes place in Catholicism, you realize that they've been coming to understand the end of the world just as we understand the end of the world, only differently. We know from Revelation 13:13 that when Satan personates Christ, he's going to call fire down out of heaven. Satan definitely has read the spirit of prophecy. But in any case, I don't want to spend time in verse 40. I just want to let you know that it is a powerful verse, and it was designed by God to awaken God's people to the fact that end time prophecy was underway. And the next event in that sequence of events is when the King of the North, the papacy, conquers the glorious land, the United States of America. And it is right there that the biggest argument over these verses takes place. The glorious land. Is the glorious land, the United States of America, a geographical entity, or is the glorious land the Seventh-day Adventist Church? And if it's the Seventh-day Adventist Church, brothers and sisters, in this verse, internally, it gets very, very difficult to defend. Because if you're saying that when the Seventh-day Adventist Church is conquered by the papacy, if you're saying that, the first thing you need to say, remember what we went through yesterday upon the testimony of two or three things established? You're saying that the papacy conquers the Seventh-day Adventist Church in verse 41 of Daniel 11. The first question you've got to ask yourself is, okay, where else is the Seventh-day Adventist Church conquered by the papacy at the end of the world in Bible prophecy? Because you need two to establish it. But the other problem internally in that verse is at that time in that verse that the papacy is conquering the glorious land, whatever it is, you see Edom, Moab, and Ammon escaping the hand of the papacy. And I told you about this meeting we had with the theologian in Oklahoma a year and a half ago that was the Hebrew and the Greek expert. And he was a good man. I'm not being critical of him. But he understood the Hebrew and the Greek better than I'll ever understand it in this life. But when you get to verse 41, the most important word in some respects in my mind is the word escape. So when I was up there giving my presentation during that meeting and describing how I understand the definition of escape, I told them this word escape in verse 41 is different than the Hebrew word escape in verse 42. And this word in verse 41 means to escape as if by slipperiness. It's as if you reach into a tub of water and try to pick up a bar of soap and it slips out of your hand. I says the primary meaning of this word escape is that whatever escapes from the hand has previously been in the hand that it escaped from. That's the main essence of the meaning of that word. And when I gave that explanation of that definition, this Hebrew scholar that was in opposition to me, remember, we're having not a debate, but a discussion on these verses, and he's sharing what he thinks verses 40 to 45 are. I'm sharing what I think verses 40 to 45 are, and we're totally different. And it's friendly, it's polite. It was Christian atmosphere, but we were adversaries. And when I'm making my explanation on what this word escape means, he interrupts from the floor and says, "That's right on." Okay, so an adversary agrees. So here's the point. If you think the Seventh-day Adventist Church is conquered by the papacy in verse 41, you have to explain who it is that escapes out of the papacy's hand that is symboled by Edom, Moab, and Ammon, and where do they go when they escape the papacy? Because I think we understand that when people begin to come out of Babylon, they come and stand with God's church. But God's church in this verse just got conquered by the papacy. Where do these people go? So, I mean, internally, if you take that position, everything falls apart. But, brothers and sisters, this is the argument. And you hear this argument wherever you go. So, this presentation, I've given you a little bit of background. Now, why are these verses important? Let me say one more thing before we start into this presentation. We haven't really started. The reason this is important, brothers and sisters, is because at the Sunday law, as Seventh-day Adventists, our probation closes. There's too many passages where you can plainly show this. Brothers and sisters, the Sunday law is the dividing line. If you have light on Sabbath and Sunday, and you come to the Sunday law that fulfills Bible prophecy, and you don't uphold the Sabbath, you receive the mark of the beast. And the biblical, historical illustrations of that is the time period of Christ. When the Jews did not follow the light in the time period of Christ, they reached a point where they were in perfect darkness. And Sister White uses that history and compares it to the Millerite time period and says those foolish virgins that did not follow on into the most holy place on October 22nd, 1844. She doesn't say they went into darkness. She says they began to direct, they continued to direct their prayers to the holy place, and who answered their prayers? Satan. Those are the illustrations of this time period when we arrive at the Sunday law. And that's why when 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 says, those of us that do not receive the love of the truth are going to be sent strong delusion. That strong delusion is paralleling the Millerite time period. It's paralleling the foolish virgins that continued to send their prayers to Satan. It's paralleling when the Jews went into perfect darkness in the time period of Christ. Brothers and sisters, probation closes at the Sunday law because God at the Sunday law is purifying His people to prepare them for the outpouring of the Holy Spirit, the repeat of Pentecost, only in a more glorious fashion. And those people that have prepared their character for the seal of God and get to participate in that time period then go out and bring those people in Babylon into the fold. So I woke up one morning in Germany at this prophecy school with the conviction that off the top of my head, I wanted to just quickly write down the arguments about the glorious land in verse 41. And I hadn't actually ever sat down and thought, well, you know, how many reasons do I understand that the glorious land is the United States and not the Seventh-day Adventist Church? You know, when someone brings it up, I deal with them what their argument is on why it's the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I deal with that and then forget about it. But I never just wrote them all down. And in a short period of time, I had written down 20 reasons. And of course, you could spend a lot of time on each of them, and we're not going to do that. But that's why we call this presentation the Glorious Argument. Because there is an argument going on, and I am only here when I'm here. I don't know what goes on here in this congregation when I'm not here. I know that there have been men in here saying that the glorious land is the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I'm not criticizing anything. I'm just being accurate. I know the environment within this cut of Adventism. And I know that in the Biblical Research Institute that right now is in discussion with myself on these subjects, I know what they're teaching as well. So it's not just... Well, the brother that is the question is for the tape, what is their teaching? When it comes to those people that are opposing what we're presenting, it seems like there is a variety of teachings. The brother that I am in direct interaction with right now is named Gerhard Fandel. He is the man that wrote the quarterly for the last quarter of last year. He's one of the members of the Biblical Research Institute. And in his last response to me, which I have with me, he says, because I had challenged him in another response, he says, you know, something is the order. This is what he says. This isn't word for word, but this is directly what he says. I want to be clear. I don't know what the last six verses of Daniel 11 represent. Okay. Now there is, in Great Controversy 356, Sister White says, the events connected with the close of probation and the need of preparation for the time of trouble have been clearly revealed, but multitudes have no more understanding of these important truths than if they had never been revealed. That's word for word. I may have kicked one or two words around. But the point is, she says, the events connected with the close of probation have been clearly revealed. And brothers and sisters, I believe the clearest illustration of the close of probation in the Bible is Daniel 12:1. You might make the argument Revelation 22:11, but I believe they go together. Daniel 12:1 is Michael standing up. Human probation closes. Revelation 22:11 tells us what Michael says as he stands up. As he's standing up, he says, he that is unjust, let him be unjust still. They go together, okay? But the clearest illustration of the close of probation is Daniel 12:1, and Sister White says, the events connected with the close of probation have been clearly revealed, and the events that lead up to Daniel 12:1 are the last six verses of Daniel 11. So when someone says, You know, what you're saying about the last six verses of Daniel 11, I know it's wrong, but I want you to understand, I don't know what those verses mean. I have a difficult time relating to that position. So I can't say for sure what he believes, but some of those people at that level believe that the glorious land of verse 41 is the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Oh, no, if you thought she said all that, here's what she said. The events connected with the closed probation and the need of preparation for the time of trouble have been clearly revealed, but multitudes have no more understanding of these important truths than if they'd never been revealed. Period. No, I'm saying that the last six verses of Daniel 11 are the events that precede Michael standing up. They are the events connected with the close of probation. And I'm glad you asked those questions, because if I wasn't being clear, that's the point I wanted to make. Sister White says, the events connected with the close of probation have been clearly revealed, and the close of probation is in Daniel 12:1. Therefore, the events connected with Daniel 12:1 are the verses that precede Daniel 12:1, right? Okay, they've been clearly revealed. But multitudes have no more understanding than if they'd never been revealed. Save your questions for the end now. Let's try getting through these points, please. First point, the word glorious in verse 41 means in sense of prominence. This is Councils on Health 338. We are not to be an obscure church, but we are to let the light shine forth that the world may receive it. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and joy in my people. God declares through his servant Isaiah, Isaiah 65:19. These words will be proved true when those who are capable of standing in positions of responsibility let the light shine forth. My point here is that, brothers and sisters, if the Seventh-day Adventist Church had lived up to the light that had been given to it, it would be the most prominent church in the world, but it's not. And usually in this culture of Adventism, what we call conservative or historic or whatever you want to call it, we understand that the Seventh-day Adventist Church has not lived up to the light that was given to it. It is not the most prominent church in the world. It isn't. So just in the definition of the word, I mean, this is a simple argument. Some of these simple arguments are simple. Some are a little bit more complex. Seventh-day Adventist Church is not the most prominent church in the world, but brothers and sisters, what is the most prominent country in the world? The United States of America. And I have a quote here, I won't read it, Testimonies, Volume 6, page 144, I will read it. Men will employ every means to make less prominent the difference between Seventh-day Adventists and the observers of the first day of the week. And she goes on. One of the things that has been pointed out in Inspiration that has been a heartbreak for some of us in Adventism is the attitude that the way we're going to win souls is by blending in with the Protestant world. So, I mean, we understand we are not the most prominent church. So the word glorious doesn't fit the Seventh-day Adventist Church, but it does fit the United States. Point number two, perhaps the strongest point, the covenant people. Brothers and sisters, we are the covenant people. Prophets and Kings 7:13. That which God purposed to do for the world through Israel, the chosen nation, he will finally accomplish through his church on earth today. He has let out his vineyard unto other husbandmen, even to his covenant-keeping people who faithfully render him the fruits in their season. Never has the Lord been without true representatives on this earth who have made his interest their own. These witnesses for God are numbered among the spiritual Israel. Now notice this. And to them will be fulfilled all the covenant promises made by Jehovah to his ancient people. Brothers and sisters, we're God's covenant people. And we receive all the covenant promises. How many promises are there in the covenant? There are three. So let's consider what those promises are. Promise number one, perhaps the most important, is we can have the mind of Christ, brothers and sisters, at the foot of the cross. right here and now. That's the first promise of the covenant. If we will come to the foot of the cross and meet the conditions of salvation, we can have a new heart and a new mind instantly. And I hope we all understand this. Romans 7, 24, 25, Romans 8, 1, Philippians 2, 5, 1 Corinthians 2, 14 through 16, and other passages teach that you and I can have the mind of Christ here and there. And that's the promise of the covenant. The second promise of the covenant is that we can have a glorified body, but we can't have that right now. We get the glorified body at the return of Christ if we're faithful, if we meet the conditions of the covenant. Philippians 3:21, 1 Corinthians 15, 51 through 57. Now, brothers and sisters, those are two of the covenant promises, but there is a third promise to God's covenant people that is found in the Bible 100 times more than those first two promises. It's from the beginning of the Bible all the way through. It's almost impossible to read the Old Testament without seeing that third covenant promise. What's the third covenant promise? A promised land, that I will give you a land to dwell in. Exodus 32, verse 13. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants, to whom thou swearest by thine own self, and saidest unto them, I will multiply your seeds as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of will I give unto your seed, and they shall inherit it forever. The covenant people were promised a land to dwell in. In Numbers 34, 1 and 2, and the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, command the children of Israel, and saying to them, when you come into the land of Canaan, this is the land that shall fall unto you for an inheritance, even the land of Canaan with the coast thereof. The land they were promised was an inheritance. I'm making that point for a specific reason. But one of the arguments is that the glorious land is God's church's people. Palestine was a land. Palestine was an inheritance. And when you get technical, legally, if there's an attorney, is there any attorney in here? One time I asked that, and there was, and they agreed. Legally, I mean, we don't need an attorney to understand this. The inheritor, the person that's going to inherit the inheritance, it's two different things. I'm the inheritor. This is what I'm going to inherit. The inheritance cannot be the inheritor. And the land is the inheritance to the people. Numbers 30. There's so many passages that you have to be very selective to deal with this subject. Possession. Genesis 17, the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession. A possession is something that someone possesses. So you have to have a person, you have to have the possessor to have the possession. They're two different things. The definition of possession is an act of having or taking into control or occupancy without regard to ownership. Something owned, occupied, or controlled. Property. In Psalm 135, 12, it says, and gave their land for a heritage, and heritage unto his people. The word heritage means property that descends to an heir. The land that is the third promise of the covenant, it's an inheritance. It's property. It's something that someone is going to possess. It cannot be the possessor. The inheritance cannot be the inheritor. They are two different entities. When I first took this, I did a presentation strictly on this fact that of the covenant promises. And I had about 16 pages of Old Testament quotes dealing with the land of promise. To take out your concordance and run through how many places the Bible deals with the fact that God promised to give his people a land. And I'm giving just a brief synopsis of this here in a presentation of 20 arguments about the glorious land. And one of the points that you can make as you pull out these passages in the Bible is that the Bible makes a distinction between the church and the land. Here's an example, Numbers 20 and 12. 20 verse 12. Ye shall not bring this congregation. Who's this speaking to? Moses. Moses will not bring this congregation. Ye shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. The congregation, the church, isn't getting brought in. Or careful. Different point now, different thought. Was Daniel the prophet careless or careful? In the book of Daniel, there are at least five places where there's an argument made that one side of the argument has to say, well, Daniel was just careless with his words. I mean, they don't actually say that, but that's the attitude. And you have to decide whether you think Daniel it was careless or careful in this sense. In verse 41, Daniel talks about the glorious land. In verse 41, Daniel talks about the glorious holy mountain. No one argues that the glorious holy mountain at the end of the world isn't God's church. There is an argument about that. People that do not, that try to apply things literally, argue and say the glorious holy mountain in verse 45 is the literal land of Israel, but I'm not dealing with that argument. What I'm saying is those people that are applying this passage spiritually as they should, they do not argue that the glorious holy mountain of verse 45 is God's church at the end of the world. There are plenty of passages to uphold that. The simplest is Isaiah 2, verse 2 and onward, but verse 2 begins by saying, and it shall come to pass in the last days. It puts the passage in context. It'll come to pass in the end of the world that God's church will be established, and it identifies God's church as the holy mountain, the holy hill, Jerusalem, Zion. At the end of the world, the glorious holy mountain, and certainly verse 45 of Daniel 11 is the end of the world because it's right before human probation closes when Michael stands up. At the end of the world, the glorious holy mountain is God's church. So, if Daniel wanted to teach that the glorious land of verse 41 was God's church at the end of the world, why did he say glorious land? Why didn't he say glorious holy mountain? In verse 41, why didn't he say in the king of the north will enter into the glorious holy mountain? Why did he say glorious land? Daniel's making a distinction in verse 41, glorious land, between glorious land and glorious holy mountain. Now, was he being careless? Did he really mean to say that the glorious land and the glorious holy mountain both represent the church? Or was he telling us there's a distinction being made here? I purpose to believe that when there is a difference like that in Scripture, that it's purposeful. It's identifying that Daniel is saying this glorious land, it's different than the glorious holy mountain. Everyone understands that the glorious holy mountain is the Seventh-day Adventist church at the end of the world. And in the book of Daniel, you'll find that if you're going to study Daniel and get into the nuts and bolts of what's the arguments in the book of Daniel, and brothers and sisters, the fact that we're in the Laodicean condition at the end of the world and we're not studying the Bible means that as Seventh-day Adventists, we don't realize that there are some arguments about Daniel. But if you take up the task of studying the book of Daniel, you'll find there are some arguments about Daniel. You're just not hearing about them because we're all sleeping. But when you get into those arguments, you'll find in the book of Daniel, there's at least five places where the arguments devolve around, well, was Daniel careless or careful? For instance, the fourth quarter of last year, in that quarterly, Gerhard Fandel, who wrote that, he taught plainly that the Hebrew word that is translated as take away in verse 31 of Daniel 11 and in verse 11 of Daniel 12, that it's the same Hebrew word that's in Daniel 8:11. And everyone that read it said amen. And brothers and sisters, it's not. They're two different Hebrew words. Two different Hebrew words. But he taught in that quarterly the same Hebrew word and everyone slept on. Now, his reasoning is, well, these two Hebrew words, they mean the same thing. No, they are not the same. They are not the same. Now, his reasoning is they meant the same thing, so it's okay for me to just tell the people it's the same Hebrew word. But it's because it's established in Adventism today that both those Hebrew words mean take away, that he can get away with that. But brothers and sisters, the fact that Daniel uses room in verse 11 of Daniel 8, and he uses sir in verse 31 and verse 11 of Daniel 11 and Daniel 12 respectively, tells me that Daniel is making a distinction because he uses those words in connection with the daily. So the theologians go in and they attempt to teach us why the word room and sir have the same definition, and they jump through a lot of hoops in Hebrew. Brothers and sisters, forget the Hebrew. It's good to look up the Hebrew. It's good to look up the Hebrew. But the first place you look before you look at the Hebrew is you look on how Daniel uses the word. Okay, in verse 11 of Daniel 8, let's look there, just so you'll follow my reasoning. I got sidetracked, but I got to finish this thought or I'll really lose you. Let's look at verse 31 of Daniel 11 first. In verse 31 of Daniel 11, verse 31 of Daniel 11, it says, Daniel 11, verse 31, I'm going to start there. It says, an arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice. Whenever you find the daily, you're going to find take away with it. And this word take away here in verse 11 is sir. It means to remove. It's the Hebrew word that's used in the Old Testament when the priest would come in and remove the ashes from under the altar. Now, if you go over to verse 11 of Daniel 12, it says, and from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, this word take away is also sir. It means to be removed. To remove. In verse 31 of Daniel 11 and verse 11 of Daniel 12, whatever the daily is, in these verses, it's saying the daily will be removed. Okay? But if you go back down to chapter 8, verse 11 now, it says, yea, he magnified himself to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away. The Hebrew word here that's translated as take away is not sur, it's room. R-U-W-M. I may be pronouncing these wrong. Doesn't matter. So, if you're going to teach people that sir and room both mean take away, then you really have to stretch the definition of room. And there's ways for the theologians to stretch it if they get into the Hebrew. But brothers and sisters, the first place you look is you see how Daniel uses the word. You see how Daniel understands that word. That's the first place to go. What's it mean to Daniel? And if you look up room, the first and primary definition of room in your Hebrew dictionary, which everyone agrees, it means to lift up and exalt. Now, the theologians in Adventism today, they walk past that and they look at secondary definitions and try to make it be take away, because as you lift up and exalt the Word of God, then you take the Bible off this podium. You take it away. So there is a way to get down to the lower levels of this meaning and say it's take away, but don't go to the Hebrew. First go to Daniel. How does Daniel use room, or does he use it? If he doesn't, then you have to go to the Hebrew, but Daniel uses it five other places in his writings. Look at Daniel 11, verse 12. Daniel 11, verse 12 says, and when he had taken away the multitude, this is speaking about a king, his heart shall be lifted up. This lifted up, this taken away, this is room. Daniel believes that room means to lift up. That is the primary definition of room. It means to lift up and exalt. Let me show you another place where Daniel uses this. Verse 36 of Daniel 11. Verse 36 of Daniel 11, it says, and the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself. This word exalt, room. Daniel uses room to mean lift up and exalt. How about verse 7 of Daniel 12? And I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, and when he held up his right hand, this word translated held up, is room. See, for Daniel, in Daniel's mind, when he used the word room, it meant to lift up and exalt, which is, by the way, the primary definition of room. So if you go back to verse 11 of Daniel 8, it says, "Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily," whatever the daily is, according to Daniel, the daily will be lifted up and exalted. Now, brothers and sisters, in Adventism today, we teach that the daily represents the work that Christ is doing in the sanctuary above, and we teach that verse 11 is dealing with the papacy. So let's read verse 11 and assume that the subject of verse 11 is the papacy. It says, "Yea, the papacy magnified himself against Christ, the prince of the host, and through the papacy, the work of Christ in the heavenly sanctuary was lifted up and exalted." Oh, brothers and sisters, it doesn't make sense. Was Daniel careful or careless when he selected room instead of sir here in verse 11 of Daniel 8? There are at least five places in the book of Daniel where you have to decide, is Daniel careful or careless? How about the word vision? The word vision in Daniel 8? Two Hebrew words in Daniel 8 that are translated as vision. There is an argument here, an argument that even William Miller addressed in his day and age. This is an argument that came right out of the foundation of Adventism, and the argument then was at the Millerites against the Protestant world. Today, the argument is within Adventism itself, although there's very few people arguing it because we are mostly sleeping. But William Miller, there's people that understood that William Miller knew that the word vision, incorrectly understood, destroys the 2300-day prophecy. See, in Daniel 8, these two words that are translated vision, one means the complete vision, and one means the snapshot. And that, the word snapshot is my definition. It seems a good way to illustrate it for people the first time. There's two words translated vision in the book, in chapter 8 of Daniel. It occurs 10 times. One of those words, visions, means the complete vision, and one means the snapshot vision. It means just one part of the vision. And if you go through very carefully with your concordance and mark where these different words are, it brings a clarity into Daniel 8 that you cannot have if you just assume that everywhere that you read vision, it means the same thing, because it doesn't mean the same thing. And for instance, in verse 13, there is a word vision. It says, "Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot?" Now, brothers and sisters, how important is that question? Pretty important question. That's the question that brings the answer that is the foundation to Adventism. Right? So we need to be straight about the question. So the question is how long is this vision? Is this vision, this word vision, does this mean the complete vision? Or does it mean the snapshot vision? And let's look at what the snapshot vision is so you can get the context of this. Look at verse 26. Verse 26 says, this, in verse 26, you have both of these Hebrew words that are translated vision. You have the word that means the complete vision, and you have the word that means just the little piece of the vision. And verse 26 says, "And the vision of the evening and morning which was told is true, wherefore shut thou up the vision, for it should be many days." Where it says, "Wherefore thou shut up the vision," that word vision means the complete vision. But the little snapshot of the vision is the vision of the 2300 days. The 2300 day, the part of the vision that dealt with the 2300 day prophecy, Daniel's told that is true, and that's the little snapshot vision. And as you trace these two words down through Daniel 8, you begin to get some clarity into it. In verse 26, it's saying, what Daniel's saying is, I want you to understand that the 2300 day prophecy is true, but shut the whole vision up. Close it up. The whole vision. And what's the whole vision of Daniel 8? The vision that begins when? In the Medes and Persians. Goes down through history. So, when you come to verse 13, William Miller made this argument. He had to make this argument against the Protestant world. If you're incorrect on the daily, you destroy the 2300-day prophecy.
Amen.
Why? Because of verse 13 and the word vision. It says, "Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision?" This is the complete vision. How long is the complete vision of Daniel 8 that begins in the times of the Medes and Persians? How long is the complete vision of the daily and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? Now, brothers and sisters, this word vision, William Miller had to argue with the Protestant world over this word vision. So I want you to understand, this is a historical argument in Adventism today. It's worth understanding. The question is how long is the entire vision? So let me give you an illustration of why William Miller says to be incorrect on the daily destroys the 2300-day prophecy, which seems to me in Adventism to be a truth we do not want to destroy. What we teach in Adventism today is that the daily represents the work of Christ in the sanctuary above, or any close facsimile to that. Is that not how you've been and taught that truth? Okay. And how was it that the papacy destroyed the work of Christ in the sanctuary, according to this fable? By the introduction of the Mass, which obscured the understanding of the sanctuary and the work of our high priest. Correct? Okay, so tell me something. When did the Mass come into history?
About 325.
Oh, so we're going to say 325. But in Paul's day and age, he said, "The mystery of iniquity doth already work." Okay, so let's give it the benefit of the doubt. Let's give it the benefit of the doubt. Let's go back to when? 50 A.D. A.D. 50. Let's say there's a historical starting point. If you really want to give them the benefit out of the beginning of the mystery of iniquity that was going to block or obscure the work of Christ in the sanctuary above, however you want to define it. That's the daily. That's the daily. And the question is, how long is the vision concerning the daily and the transgression of desolation? Brothers and sisters, how long? Well, you have the ending point in the next verse. What's the ending point in verse 14? Now, the time is 2300 days. What's the ending point that we all know for the 2300 days? 1844. But we also have the time, correct? 2300 days. So the time is 2300 years. So if we give the theologians the benefit of the doubt and say that this blockage of Christ's work in the sanctuary above began in AD 50, because the question is how long is the vision concerning the daily? We know the next verse gives us the ending point. So what's the starting point? Oh, well, if it's AD 50 and we're going to go 2300 days, what happens to us? When is the sanctuary cleansed, brothers and sisters? 2350. It's not going to be cleansed for another 300 years. That's why William Miller took this word vision in connection with the daily and had an argument way back when. If you're wrong on the daily, you destroy the 2300-day prophecy. But if you say, as the pioneers did, that the daily represents paganism in general and pagan Rome specifically, and the question is how long is the vision concerning the daily and the transgression of desolation? It means the entire vision. When did the entire vision start? Started in the time periods of the Medes and Persians. Read Daniel 8. Started in the time periods of Medes and Persians. And in the time period of the Medes and Persians, you know where you're at? You're in the history of 457. The pioneers were right on. And to be incorrect on the daily is to destroy the 2300-day prophecy. So today the theologians, when it comes to verse 13, and here's the point I want to make, and I may have already lost you. When it comes to verse 13, today the theologians have to emphasize that the word vision in verse 13 doesn't really mean the complete vision. They have to avoid it.
How did you get AD
50? I didn't get AD 50. The reason that what I'm saying is that as Brother Duane pointed out, the earliest history that you can truly make an argument that the mass came in was 325. Okay, so if you want to say that the mass came into history, the Catholic mass, you can guesstimate 325 if you want to look for a point. But what I was saying, okay, if you're going to use 325 for the starting point, let's give them even more of the benefit of doubt, and let's admit that Paul said that the mystery of iniquity was even at work in his day and age, Paul. So even though the mass wasn't started, we know that the mystery of iniquity was active at least in this time period of AD 50. So to give them the benefit of the doubt, because they need more time to make this 2300-day prophecy come into alignment with 1844, to give them the benefit of the doubt, the earliest starting point for this vision that you could go to, if you're giving them the benefit of the doubt, is AD 50. It's just... giving them everything I can give them, and they still are way off the point. But the point isn't so much that, it's this. If you get to this level with these brethren, and you get to the word vision in verse 13, then they cannot uphold the definition of this vision, which means complete vision. The question is, how long is the complete vision? If you're talking about the complete vision of Daniel 8, you have to have a starting point in the times of the Medes and Persians, and you can't put the mystery of iniquity, the mass, in the time period of the Medes and Persians. So the question is, once again, is Daniel careful or careless? Did he want to use this word vision that meant just snapshot vision that emphasizes 1844? Or did he want to use the word complete vision? And what I'm saying is when it comes to the book of Daniel, I think he's careful, not careless. There are other examples of this. Takeaway, vision, sanctuary. Because we're still in Daniel 8. Let me show you another one. Daniel 8, verse 11. It says, "Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down." There's a Hebrew word here that's translated as sanctuary in this verse. And this Hebrew word can be used to identify God's sanctuary, or it can be used to identify a pagan sanctuary. Okay? It can be used either way. But notice, read on, verse 12. "And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced, and it prospered. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint, and said unto that certain saint which spake, How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot?" Here's another word, sanctuary. Next verse. "And he said unto me, Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." Brothers and sisters, in verses 13 and 14, the Hebrew word that is translated as sanctuary is only used to identify God's sanctuary. Period. Maybe his earthly sanctuary, and maybe his heavenly sanctuary, but it is exclusively used to identify God's sanctuary. Now, if you believe the daily is Christ's work in the heavenly sanctuary, then when you're dealing with verse 11, what you're saying is, "Yea, the papacy magnified himself to Christ, and through the papacy, the work of Christ in the heavenly sanctuary was removed, and the place of Christ sanctuary in heaven was cast down." But if Daniel had wanted us to understand that this was God's sanctuary that was cast down here in verse 11, why didn't he use the same Hebrew word that he used in verses 13 and 14, which is a Hebrew word that's translated as sanctuary that is only identifying God's sanctuary? Was he careful or was he careless? I think the fact that he used a different Hebrew word means he was making a distinction that, as students of prophecy, were expected to understand correctly. Now, how did the pioneers understand verse 11? How did the pioneers understood it this way? Verse 11, they said this was pagan Rome, not papal Rome. They said, yea, he, pagan Rome, magnified himself against the prince of the hosts. Pagan Rome magnified itself against Christ at his birth and at his death. Tried to kill him when he was born, put him on the cross. Pagan Rome magnified themselves to Christ, and through or by pagan Rome, paganism was lifted up and exalted. And brothers and sisters, the reason that we call pagan Rome pagan Rome is because they are the power that lifted up and exalted paganism. And then it goes on and says, and the place of pagan Rome's sanctuary was cast down. And the pioneers point out that pagan Rome had a sanctuary. It was called the Pantheon Temple. Not only did they have a sanctuary and a temple, it was the very place where they exalted paganism. So it's even consistent with what the verse is teaching. The verse is teaching about how pagan Rome exalts paganism, and it identifies the sanctuary where the exaltation took place. It says the place. Now, it doesn't say the sanctuary. It says the place of the sanctuary was cast down. And where was this Pantheon temple at that they exalted paganism? It was in the city of Rome. And in the year 330, the emperor of Rome, Constantine, cast down the city of Rome by moving the capital of the Roman Empire from the city of Rome to the city of Constantinople. That's the pioneer understanding. And brothers and sisters, the verse is consistent with itself, and it's consistent with the words that Daniel employs without having to make Daniel seem like he's careless. So, when it comes to the glorious land and the glorious holy mountain, it's the same type of argument. Is he careless or careful? If he wants to say this is the Seventh-day Adventist Church in verse 41, why doesn't he say the glorious holy mountain? You following my logic? Okay. Okay. Point number four, Daniel's usage. What do I mean by Daniel's usage? Notice Daniel 7:24. Daniel 7:24 says, and the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings. Daniel teaches that the papacy, in order to get established on the throne of the earth, has to overcome three geographical areas. These three kings are the Heruli, the Ostrogoths, and the Vandals, and we all understand that. That's three geographical areas that were going to be conquered, three nations, if you will. And notice Daniel 8, verse 9. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great towards the south, toward the east, and towards the pleasant land. Pioneers correctly understood this verse to say that this little horn represents both pagan and papal Rome as the verses advance. But in this verse, pagan Rome is being specified, and it's saying that before pagan Rome would take control of the world, it had to conquer Egypt, Syria, and Israel. The pleasant land here, Palestine, whatever you want to call it. Here, Daniel calls it the pleasant land. In Daniel 11, he calls it the glorious land. Notice Daniel 11, verse 16 and 17. I'll pull this point together in a moment. Papal Rome had to conquer three geographical areas before it was established on the throne of the earth. Pagan Rome had to conquer three geographical areas before it was established on the throne of the earth. In Daniel 8, 9, these three geographical areas are pointed out. And in Daniel 11, verses 16 and 17, Daniel is repeating this. This is this conquering of these same three geographical areas. Read Daniel and the Revelation by Uriah Smith if you want to find this out more in depth. Verse 16 of Daniel 11 says, then he that come against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land. Here's Daniel using the word glorious land. And which by his hand shall be consumed. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and shall give him the daughter of woman, corrupting her, but she shall not stand by his side, neither be for him. The he that comes against him, in verse 16, is pagan Rome coming against the previous king that's been under discussion in this verse, the last king of Greece, the last Syrian king. It says in verse 16, but pagan Rome shall come against him. It will conquer Syria. And then it's going to conquer the glorious land, Israel. And then it's going to go capture Egypt, the king of the south. Same three places as Daniel 8, verse 9. Pioneer understanding and correct. But what am I saying here? I'm saying that when Daniel here in verse 16 uses the word glorious land, he is identifying a nation among three nations that are getting conquered by pagan Rome. How does Daniel use the word glorious land? He uses it to identify a nation that is being conquered by Rome. Pardon me? It was Palestine at that time. The ancient glorious land. But when you come to verse 41, it's the modern glorious land. After the cross. Point number 5, Daniel 11, verse 14, Rome establishes the vision. We discussed this yesterday a little bit. This is an argument that William Miller had with the Protestants of his day and age. In verse 14, is the robbers of thy people one of the Syrian kings, or is the robbers of thy people pagan Rome? William Miller believed it was pagan Rome. I was amazed when I realized that our theologians now have reverted to believe that it's a severe Syrian king. Pioneers understood the robbers of thy people in verse 14 to be pagan Rome. It says in verse 14, and in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south, and also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. Brothers and sisters, in Bible prophecy, the power that exalts itself and falls is Rome. But more importantly, this verse says that Rome establishes the vision. And we just read those things, so I want to make another point to the last point, although this is its own point as well. It's Rome that is the pattern that establishes this testimony in the book of Daniel. Rome establishes the vision. How, when pagan Rome took control of the world, it had to conquer three geographical areas. Daniel 8, verse 9 and 11, verses 16 and 17. When papal Rome took control of the world, it had to conquer three geographical areas. When modern Rome takes control of the world, it will have to overcome three obstacles: the king of the south, the glorious land, and Egypt. Now you tell me, if Rome establishes the vision, and pagan Rome, the three obstacles for pagan Rome were geographical areas, the three obstacles for papal Rome were geographical areas, what are the king of the south, the glorious land, and Egypt for modern Rome? They're geographical areas. Is the Seventh-day Adventist Church a geographical area? No, it's a spiritual entity. But the United States of America is a geographical area. Rome establishes a vision. Point 5. Point 6. Context of the chapter. Brothers and sisters, read Daniel and Revelation by Haskell, Uriah Smith, the writings of the pioneers. Just read Daniel 11. Every conquering in struggle in Daniel 11 is over geography. The established pattern in Daniel 11 is geography, geography, geography. And the people that are arguing that the glorious land in the United States is the Seventh-day Adventist Church, many of them do not argue verse 40. They say, okay, verse 40 is the collapse of the Soviet Union. I can accept that. So they go all the way to verse 40. They agree with you. Geography, 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 geography. But then when you get to verse 41, the struggle is no longer for geography. It's for a spiritual entity. And what I'm suggesting, even though I'm not a theologian, when God establishes a pattern, a trend internally in a passage of Scripture, He does not change it without giving us some evidence that He's going to change it. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. If you're going to say that the glorious land is no longer geography, it's a spiritual entity, you have to give some kind of reasoning why God changes suddenly here at the end of the chapter, changes the pattern that He's established all the way through. You can't just say, well, because I think so. Point number 7, we looked at last night. The three abominations of desolation. Brothers and sisters, Sister White is clear. that the fulfillment of the third abomination, the first abomination of desolations was fulfilled by pagan Rome in the AD 70 time period when they placed the mark of their authority inside the sacred precincts, which was a sign for the Christians to flee. The second abomination of desolation was the Dark Ages, when the man of sin was setting in the temple of God and trampled down the holy city for 1,206 years. 2 Thessalonians, Revelation 11, verse 2. In the Great Controversy, page 47 and onward, Sister White says, during this time of compromise, when the papacy was getting established in the Christian church, it was understood by the true Christians that they had to separate. And they separated and fled into the wilderness for 1,206 years. The same prophetic characteristics of the first abomination of desolation. And the third abomination of desolation, according to the spirit of prophecy, is when the mark of Rome's authority, once again, is placed in a place where it ought not to be, and that's the United States of America, and more specifically, it's in the Constitution, destroying the Constitution, the separation of church and state. That is a sign for Christians to flee. Now, what we were emphasizing last night is that within that scenario, when pagan Rome came in and placed its standards, it unexpectedly withdrew. And this has happened once again because the Sunday law came into history in the United States in 1888 with the Blair Bill, but then Rome mysteriously withdrew. We're supposed to be out of the cities since 1888. But that's not the point here. What I'm saying is in this threefold description of the abomination of desolation, it is identifying that there is a sense that the glorious land carries with it a sacredness. Now, you can make an argument that the Seventh-day Adventist Church has a sacredness connected with it, and I'm not denying that. But I want you to understand that the United States of America has a role in Bible prophecy, and its role is to be the great defender of religious liberty. And this was accomplished by the Lord. It was His design, and He accomplished it through the Constitution. And when the mark of Roman authority overturns the Constitution of the United States, this is part of the story of the glorious land, the role of the glorious land in Bible prophecy. It's being conquering, being the sign that the end is come. We went over that last night. I want to read you this. I mentioned it last night in connection with this, Maranatha 193. The Lord has done more for the United States than any other country upon which the sun shines. Here He provided an asylum for His people where they could worship Him according to the dictates of conscience. Here Christianity has progressed in its purity. The life-giving doctrine of one mediator between God and man has been freely taught. Notice this. God designed that this country should ever remain free for all people to worship Him in accordance with the dictates of conscience. He designed that its civil institutions in their expansive production should represent the freedom of the gospel privileges. The United States was designed by God. How many other countries in the world have we been told that God designed? There is a sense that there is a sacredness to the United States, and its sacredness, it revolves around that it has been designed to be the great defender of religious liberty. And as we pointed out in Mark, the abomination of desolation does not just come into the holy place. In Mark, he says, in a place where it ought not. When the Sunday law comes in to the United States, overturning the Constitution. Of course, they withdrew in 1888. Point number eight. Pardon me? Yeah. I wasn't saying that He didn't design other countries. I'm saying how many other countries are there? You just note that at the end of the world, the one He points out that He designed to fulfill this purpose is the United States. Yeah, you want a break? We're going till 12. Let me get just a little bit longer, and then we'll take a break. Get a couple of easy points on. One, another point. Daniel's development. There is a rule that we understand called Repeat and Enlarge. Some of us understand it by the title Repeat and Enlarge. That title, I believe, was developed by Louis Weir. At least he promoted that title. And it's commonly understood in Adventism is that Bible prophecy repeats previous prophecy and enlarges. Okay, and we understand that. Daniel 2 establishes the kingdom of Bible prophecy. Daniel 7 repeats those kingdoms of Bible prophecy, but enlarges upon them. Daniel 8 repeats them, but it enlarges upon them. Daniel 11 repeats those, but enlarges upon them. This was understood by James White when Uriah Smith first presented that the king of the north in Daniel 11, verse 36 and onward, was not the papacy. He did it in the Dime Tabernacle in Battle Creek, Michigan, biggest church in Adventism at that time. Uriah Smith gave a sermon that morning saying the king of the north was Turkey. And as soon as he was done with that sermon, and you think about this, I imagine Loma Linda may be one of the biggest churches university churches in Adventism. Imagine that a preacher there on Sabbath morning is giving a sermon, and as soon as he's done, when everybody's walking out to go out and do whatever we do after the sermon, instead of everybody walking out, somebody comes up and gives another sermon completely contradicting what that pastor just said, because that's what happened. Uriah Smith gave a presentation on why the King of the North was Turkey, and as soon as he was done, instead of breaking up, James White came up on the pulpit and gave a sermon on why the King of the North is the papacy. And that started the controversy. And you just imagine that happening in the biggest church in Adventism. And James White got rebuked for Ellen White. Not because he was wrong on who the King of the North was, but because it was inappropriate to do that publicly in that fashion. But James White had one argument that he went to over and over again as he argued with Uriah Smith over that subject. And it's this. If Rome's the last power in Daniel 2, and Rome's the last power in Daniel 7, and Rome's the last power in Daniel 8, then Rome is the last power in Daniel 11. That's repeat and enlarge. The pioneers understood repeat and enlarge, even if they didn't have the title for that principle that Louis Weir put on it. And brothers and sisters, where is it in Daniel 2, Daniel 7, or Daniel 8 that the Seventh-day Adventist Church is conquered by the papacy? Just not there. It's not there. Now, it should be there. Daniel's structure. Notice this. This is great. Point number 9. Daniel's structure. Prophets and Kings 4:58. From the rise and fall of nations. From the rise and fall of nations, as made plain in the books of Daniel and Revelation, we need to learn how worthless is mere outward and worldly glory. Bible Training School, December 1st, 1912. The prophet Daniel described the kingdoms that would rise and fall. Now, brothers and sisters, the rise and fall of kingdoms, the rise and fall of nations is the subject of Daniel and Revelation, according to Ellen White. Seventh-day Adventist Church and nation? Is the United States a nation? See, it's how you're choosing that is going to determine how consistent you are with spirit prophecy. A couple more points. We've got many more points, but we'll take a break. But give me, there's a couple quick points here to get out of the way. Point number 10, Daniel and Revelation. Many ministers make no effort to explain Revelation. In it, the same line of prophecy as is taken up as in Daniel. Some prophecy God has repeated, thus showing that the importance must be given to them. The Lord does not repeat things that are of no great consequence. Brothers and sisters, Sister White is clear that in the book of Revelation, the same line of prophecy is taken up as in the book of Daniel. So let me ask you this. Where is it in the book of Revelation that the Seventh-day Adventist Church is conquered by the papacy? Where is it in the book of Revelation that the United States is conquered by the papacy? Revelation 13:11. It's there. Point number 11, Daniel in the Bible. We read several of these last night, 2 Corinthians 13:1, in the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every word be established. Where is it in the Bible, other than verse 41 of Daniel 11, that the Seventh-day Adventist Church is conquered by the papacy? Has to be somewhere if we're going to establish that as truth. Where is it? It isn't there. It isn't there. Point number 12. The sequence in Daniel and Revelation. After the glorious land in verse 41, you have the Egypt in verse 42 and 43. We're suggesting the glorious land in verse 41 is the United States and Egypt is the world. In Revelation 13, verse 11, the United States speaks as a dragon. It falls to Rome. And then in verses 14 and 15, it goes out and commands the world to set up an image of the beast. It's the same sequence. First, the United States, the glorious land. Then the world, Egypt. First, the United States speaks as a dragon. Then it commands the world to set up an image of the beast. Revelation 17 has the same sequence. One is, and one is yet to come. Shall we take a prayer and have a break?